morning. My name is Craig Schreiner. And I've had a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism, which began March 7, 1978. And it was at that time I had my last drink, only through the power of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's great to be here sober. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me, Alan. I appreciate to come, especially in lieu of the speakers that were here last night. I hope this isn't a letdown for you this morning. Tom Ivester is a pillar of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say that because it's true, not to flatter him. And Peggy, of course, is a pillarette. And unfortunately, I was arriving at the time Dick was speaking, but I know he's what I call a stormtrooper for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a privilege to be here in such company. And even more so in the company of you that are here on a Saturday morning, bright and early and on time. And I can't thank you enough, because that is you've honored me just by that alone. Pockets of enthusiasm, the theme, willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness. We're really cutting right to the chase here. That's something that I find an essential part of my wake-up call every morning, and it's woven into the fabric of sobriety and the discipline that I have been able to muster up in this recovery. I have the disease of alcoholism, and it doesn't go away. It can be arrested, provided I do certain things. This disease, as it was described to me, explained to me, unveiled to me through people and fellowship and people of authority, is fourfold. It's physical. When I take a drink of alcohol, I have an allergic reaction to that chemical compound. And I cannot tell you when I will be able to stop drinking. It's something that I don't really quite understand. I know that many doctors don't, and psychiatrists and politicians and religious theologians, they really can't explain what this allergy is. And it took me a while to understand that once I drink, I cannot stop. The last time that I took a drink was after my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, which was when I was 24. And I drank for another 16 or 18 months continuously by taking one drink after my first AA meeting. In fact, on the way home from my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I thought to myself when I sat in that car that, my God, this is the most unbelievable experience that I've ever had, and that from this day forward, with all the resolution I can muster up in my self-will compartment, that I am convinced, based on this meeting, that I have to now control my drinking. I remember having that thought sitting in my car, and thinking, I've got to do this. I've got to control my drinking, because look at those people that I am absolutely not alike, and I have nothing in common with any of them. And then I bought a six-pack of beer, because the fear began to build as I drove out of that parking lot, to the point where I had to consume a six-pack of or how many I drank, I don't remember, on the way home, to tell my parents about the experience I just had, and begin lying immediately and covering up my drinking. But the last time that I took that drink, when I kicked in that allergic reaction, it was 16, maybe 18 months before I stopped drinking again, continuously. It's a mental disease in that if I'm left to my own device, or my own devices, I will basically be dishonest. Why? Because I am motivated by self-centered fears. That was the sole motivation of my life when I got up in the morning, was what can I do to combat the sense of impending doom that hangs over me like a cloud everywhere I go. And in that inability to deal with all that fear, the only thing I knew how to do was to lie, cheat, and steal. Whatever I had to do to rationalize my drinking, I did it, and I never gave it a second thought. If that meant lying to my parents, or lying to myself, every different form of dishonesty that I could display, I did. It didn't matter. What mattered was that I had to range this thought process, and I didn't care if it meant being dishonest. But I couldn't see that. That rationalization took over. It's an emotional disease. The first time I had a drunk, I transcended into a blackout, because I can't tell you when it actually happened, but all I know is I woke up the next day. But there was something in this alcohol that absolutely made me impervious to all the pressures I was experiencing at that age, at 13, when I had that first drunk. You know, the peer pressure, the acceptance, you're separating from your parents, you're 13, you're 14 years old, you don't want to be with them anymore, your brothers are a pain in the ass, you know, all the things that are starting to gather around you, and the pressure was alleviated by alcohol. I didn't have to worry about dealing with envy or talking about jealousy or, you know, dealing with my anger or laziness or all these other things that have to do with emotional stability. All I did was drink and it went away. And alcohol released me from that in my first drunk, my very first drunk, at least the part I remember. And last but not least, it's a spiritual disease. I really shut myself off from the spirit of the light. There was no room in my world for God or anything that resembled a power greater than myself. My previous experiences with organized religion diluted my attitude to the point where I was disgusted with those hypocrites and really what could they offer. And if for experiences I'll tell you later on and share with you, I, you know, was almost well-founded in this attitude of ignorance to a power greater than myself and belligerence, and that I hated the concept of God. Or actually, I felt that I had been abandoned by this God. And my sponsor that I have today made it very clear to me that in this recovery that there were certain things that I needed to know, he first wanted me to read page 27 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where Roland, I guess it is seeking out the help of one of the greatest psychiatrists in the world, Carl Jung, and I understand he was a colleague of Sigmund Freud, who I guess these two individuals at the time were the world's leading psychoanalysts. And Roland is there after another binge or drunk, just pleading with this doctor, is there anything you can do to help me? And this great doctor, in all his humility, was basically telling him, there's, you know, hands up in the air. Alcoholics, as chronic as you are, I've never had any success with them. The gates of hell are coming in around Roland, and he's begging this doctor, isn't there anything that you can tell me or help me with to get rid of this alcoholism? And Jung looked at him and said, the only thing I can tell you is that people that have had vital spiritual experiences are the only ones that have been able to deal with this this drinking, but I've never seen anybody like you, resentment breath, recover. And here's this man who's, you know, literally gone across the ocean and he's in Europe and he's trying to seek the help to get rid of this alcoholism, and this great doctor is telling him, sorry, you need a spiritual experience. The ideas and attitudes and emotions that used to guide your life or that actually got you here, you need to sort of get rid of those because they don't work, and you need to have a whole new set of ideas to motivate you and dominate the way that you think. And these come through a vital spiritual experience. And then this is written in the big book in italics so that they're calling special attention to it. My sponsor said, you know, on the bottom of that page it says seek spiritual experience. To find out what this really is. So the next reading that my sponsor required was this, learning a little more about this spiritual experience. So I read that back of the book, and sure enough, it goes on to describe this thing as, for a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, myself included, being something of what William James describes as a spiritual experience of the educational variety. I didn't get a sudden upheaval and a bolt of lightning and suddenly I was clear on what I needed to do to recover. Mine was a slow educational variety, and it went on to describe this spiritual experience and these things that need to happen that are vital. And looking up the word vital, vital is life-giving. Vital means it's absolutely essential. Vital means it's vital is what it means. Not only just a spiritual experience, but a vital spiritual experience. And in reading these two pages about this religious or this spiritual experience, it goes on to talk about that this isn't a religious conversion; it is a spiritual experience. And in there, it describes the indispensables, the things that are vital to having this spiritual experience, and they are willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness. And the theme of this conference of Pockets of Enthusiasm. And as all things in this that are written in this wonderful big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's also a little disclaimer that comes with it. These two gentlemen really knew how to deal with Mr. Ying and Mr. Yang here, really knew how to deal with every aspect of this disease of alcoholism. And they quoted this man named Hubert Spencer, I guess, that said that there's one thing that will keep Craig Schreiner in everlasting ignorance, you know, for the rest of his life, and that's contempt prior to investigation. Well, yeah, but you don't understand that I'm, you know, a little young for this disease. I have never lost a job that I can remember. You know, I don't have any DUIs. You know, I still have the job that I currently hold. You know, I don't have to drink. I sure want to, but I don't have to, and all this jargon that goes on with all that. At any rate, those two words, as I've become so aware of it, yeah, but, is when my mind closes, is when I'm somehow now going to differentiate why I don't need to do things that were described in the ego deflation so well last night. Well, yeah, but, you know, that's for them. That's not for me. But that's the safeguard today in my own mind, the way that I can click off my own little inventory and catch myself. Because it's amazing. And I've gotten a little sophisticated recently. I can say, well, although, however, you know, I can spell yeah, but a lot of different ways. So I have to be aware of that. The last bit of required reading, as far as my sponsor is concerned, was then on page 45. And I read this once and didn't quite I understood the words, but I didn't understand its meaning. And it wasn't till I was having a sense of impending doom attack. Some people call it anxiety or whatever, but the book, you know, really describes it so beautifully, the sense of impending doom. I'll never forget, it was after Super Bowl, right after a Super Bowl party that I was at. It was all AAs. I was in having a wonderful time with those people, you know, and about 14 months dry in Alcoholics, and I was sitting at one of these Super Bowl parties, you know, drinking coffee and eating potato chips, and having a good time. And as I was leaving that quote party, a thought occurred to me: drink. This just isn't worth it. Drink. You know, there's no need for this. And I became extremely anxious. And rather than do that, I pulled over and called my sponsor, and he said, well, come over here immediately. And I drove over to my sponsor's house, and he, seeing that I was really shaky and on that fence at 12 or 14 months of dryness in Alcoholics Anonymous, opened up the big book to page 45 and said, read this. And it said it was the lack of power that was the dilemma. Huh? And when I read that, I was ready to read that at that point in time. I had thought that after not drinking for 14 months should be sufficient enough to change my entire life, that I should now be happy or that things should really be happening. But all I had done is just not drank for 14 months. I really hadn't jumped into the recovery delineated by these steps and traditions and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just kind of hanging around the perimeters in the back of the room and on the wings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really wasn't in the breast of it. And I was ready to read that. It said the lack of power, that was the dilemma. And that's also in italics. And it said, you know, that the reason that this book was written was to put me in touch with a power greater than myself. And the next sentence is one word, obviously. You know, that power had to be greater than myself, obviously. It wasn't too obvious to me. Well, that concludes the intellectual portion of my discussion this morning. What I've tried to regurgitate for you, no better term to describe that, were 9 paragraphs that my sponsor started the foundation of the recovery that I know today. Because it's important that I always remember those. And it's one thing for me to tell you those words or to try to, you know, misquote what's going on in the big book or these parts of the big book. But that journey from my mind to my heart, that 12 or 14 inches or whatever it is, from knowing what I just told you to understanding it, is what I want to talk about now. Because that's really what this has been, that from the head to the heart. The best way to describe me is a situation that occurred, as I remember, one of the memories I have as a child growing up in Akron, Ohio. I was 7 or 8, and snowed so hard one night that the school was canceled. That's like one of those unbelievable miracles when you're a kid. You know, you wake up, and you didn't even plan it. It came out of nowhere. You know what I mean? No school. I mean, what greater thing in the world? Especially when your school is a Catholic school full of, you know, Sister Mary resentments, you know? So here I am, I got a free day, and I didn't even plan it. Now, all my brothers were content to stay in the house and do, you know, watch television, play football, you know, all that sort of stuff. I got in the notion that I should go shovel snow. And I thought, well, I could make some money, and it just seems like a fun thing to do. So I bundled up and got the snow shovel. My parents didn't even take me seriously. They just thought, well, yeah, go out and struggle with our walk, and then you'll be back in a few minutes. So I got our walk done and did the driveway, and a lady across the street motioned to me, and I walked across the street. She said, do you want to do mine? I said, yeah, that'd be great. And I did her walk and did her driveway, and she paid me a lot of money. And she said, the lady across the street called and wanted to know if you would do her walk. So I went over and I shoveled her walk, and then I continued on this journey down the street through this referral system all the way down. Didn't have to make a call, didn't have to do anything, didn't have to advertise, and I shoveled snow all for several hours. At the end of this day, I had $6 or $7, let's say. I was 7 years old, I'm 46, so that's what, 39 years ago. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money to have when you're 7 years old, $7 or $8. Now, the thought occurred to me, take it home, put it in the piggy bank, you know, you're going to be a Boy Scout soon, you're going to buy your uniform, or, you know, your mother's birthday's coming up, or, you know, and that thought just went right over my head, one ear and out the other. Like, we don't need that, that doesn't fit. And a thought occurred to me to go to my favorite place in the whole world. And I'll never forget when my mother took me into this place. When the door opened in this establishment, all I remember seeing was this big mirror behind this beautiful marble bar. And all these shiny glasses were up there, big glasses, little glasses, fat glasses, skinny glasses. There were a lot of people in there having a lot of fun. There were these stools that had these stainless steel pedestals, and they swiveled around and around and around. And the place was just full of gaiety and you know, noise. And I'm thinking, man, this has got to be the greatest place in the world. And it was a soda fountain. And I thought, that's where I'm going. I'm going to Blackie's. That was the name of it. And so I go flying into Blackie's, and I never forget, I knocked that door open, and I said, hey, everybody, Cokes are on me, you know? And I took this money that I had, and I started buying total strangers ice cream sundaes, and I was eating candy, my parents didn't know where I was, and I was just consuming all these floats and everything. And I was on this binge. And I was being this little big shot. No one taught me how to be a little big shot. I didn't see it in the pictures. It just intuitively came to me to do this. And so I did this, you know. And at the end of my spree, I realized, oh, my God, it's getting late. You know, it's dinner time. And I bought a few gifts for my brothers and my mom. I figured, I better sort of pave the way back into the house because I was gone for so long. And I'll never forget going back home and then giving gifts to my brothers and everything. And I bought a model, though, that intrigued me. It was a car that had big motor sticking out of it and huge wheels, and it had these flames painted on the side of it, and there was this big blonde girl in a little bathing suit leaning up against it looking at me. And the reason I wanted to have this model was because the guy that I idolized lived next door. His name was Ernie. And Ernie had a 55 Chevy, and it looked a little bit like this thing. And when he'd come down the street, the car would rumble. And he had these girlfriends that were like bigger than life. And I figured that if I could build this model, I could, you know, be Ernie's friend, and we'd go double date or something like that. Because I remember seeing in his room one time, he had all these models that he built. He had planes and fighter planes, and he had aircraft, and he had cars, and he had all these models that he built. He was really skilled at it. And I was thinking, I'll build this model. He'll accept me into his, you know, his covey of friends, and we'll double date. And at any rate, I got this model back. And I struggled with this thing for a couple of hours. I was upstairs, you know, after shoveling all the snow. Now I've got this time at night, and I'm going to put this model together. Well, you know, inside of 2 hours, I made a mess of this thing. There was like 200 parts in this. And I remember ripping everything out and just spreading it all out. I kept taking out rack after rack after rack after rack of parts. And I'm thinking, you know, this doesn't look anything like the picture. And I struggled with it for a couple hours. At the end of this experience, I'd made a mess of this thing. It did not look anything like it was supposed to. There was, you know, glue everywhere. There was paint on the floor. And I really made a mess of this. And it was about $2.50. It was a lot of money. Just as I went downstairs to, you know, sort of cry on my dad's lap, and I was so ashamed that I had, you know, had failed miserably at this, I got up and my foot was sort of stuck to the floor with some of that glue, and there was a piece of paper on it, and I stuck on my sock, and I rip it off, and it says instructions. Now, what's the point of all this? The point of all this is this. Here's an individual that has enough energy to go out and shovel snow for several hours. All of a sudden, I turn into this immediate big shot, and as soon as I get home, I have the inability to ask for help. It never occurred to me when I was getting this object lesson in humility about read the instructions that it never occurred to me once, well, if Ernie's so good at building these models, why don't you ask him to help you? Or ask your father, you know, to help you. Or ask your brother, you know, do you know how to do this? Can you show me how to do this? Those thoughts never occurred to me. What occurred to me was just take it out, jam it together, stuff to the thing, enough glue will make it work, and then you take it down and you can become the hero in your grade school when you walk in for show and tell. I didn't need to be taught any of this. This all just sort of happens. And I had the inability to ask for help. It never occurred to me, never even occurred to me, just like it meant to take the money home and save it. So here's this little big shot that has the inability to ask for help. Now take that personality with that kind of energy and throw something flammable on it, like alcohol. I mean, are we ready? Is the stage set? It's Friday night. I'm 13 years old. My pals and I have just confiscated a case of Stroh's beer from Dr. Hartenstein's garage. But these long necks, it's August. It's about 95 degrees out. These have been sitting in the hot garage all day long. So we popped these Stroh's beers or whatever they were, and we started to drink. I'll never forget the first two sips I took, it came out my nose because it was so hot. And I didn't realize what this stuff was, and it just came right out my nose. And that burns and it hurts, but I kept drinking it because they were drinking it. And after about four of these beers, I think it was about three or four, I remember sitting at the fire, and I remember all of a sudden feeling as warm as the fire that was in front of me. And all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I feel good. My friends around me are all now in slow motion, and everything is going at a really nice pace all of a sudden. And I'm taking it all in, and everybody's laughing and looking at me. And I don't even know, am I not hearing some of these things, or am I not hearing that? And next thing I know, I was overwhelmed with this unbelievable feeling. This unbelievable feeling of everything is fine. Everything is fine. It was as if this great power came sweeping over me and said, everything is fine. And the unfortunate thing with this was that it only lasted about 5 minutes. Because after that, everything is fine, I don't remember anything. I do remember the next morning, however, hearing voices, and I knew my eyes were open, but I couldn't see anybody. And I kept hearing some people going, look at him, look at him. And I still couldn't hear it. All of a sudden, I'm smelling things, like, what is that? You know, there's like, that's urine, and what's that other stuff? And, you know, and I'm still can't see anything. And all of a sudden, I can't breathe. And I'm hearing my friends laughing, look at him, look at him. And I realize that I'm stuck in my sleeping bag head first. And my feet are sticking out of the end, and I don't know this yet. I'm kind of coming to, like Tom was talking about, you know, coming to out of one of these blackouts. That moment of terror and desperation is like, what happened? Where am I? What did go on? What's going on? What did I do? Where? And I'm kind of adding all these things up while I'm coming out of my cocoon that morning, and I finally come out of my sleeping bag, and there I am. I miraculously made it. And my friends are all laughing at me, and I'm naked, and I got my tennis shoes on. And I'm sort of adding all this, sort of doing the checklist. Okay, where am I? I'm naked. There's my friends laughing at me. Why are my pants in that tree smoking on fire? You know? You know, how did they get there? How did I get out of them? And I'm trying to add all this stuff up. My very first drunk. At any rate, I get through this whole experience, and all I can remember as I'm now kind of coming to and realizing as I'm standing, oh my God, I've never felt this sick. Why do I feel this sick? My head's ready to explode. I'm standing here naked. I feel like I'm going to throw up. I have to go to the bathroom. All I remember was this was not fun. But remembering what had happened the night before, all of a sudden, oh yeah, that's right, it was that alcohol. I'll never forget that feeling I had. And I couldn't wait to drink again. Humiliated in front of my friends, naked, I can't wait to drink again. Something's wrong here. Alcohol did that to me, whatever it was in that very first drunk. It was that unbelievable power greater than myself or whatever that just said everything is going to be fine. From that day on, I did whatever I could, devising, rationalizing, lying, cheating, to drink as much as I could, as often as I could. And I continued to do that for 13 years, to the point where on March 6, 1978, I fell on my knees in total desperation after living a lie for many years, having gone to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and then drank for another 14 months, realized that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'd been taken to the threshold of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did not go in. I'll never forget when I was laying in bed, I think this was when I was 24, about the day before I went to my meeting, and I couldn't get out of bed. I was so paralyzed by these fears. And I'd happened to be staying at my parents' home I think I was in transition from one apartment to the other, and I found myself at home at 24 and not being able to drink like I normally could because I was in my parents' house. I had to hide. I didn't want them to know that I drank like this. Here I am laying flat on my back, and I cannot get out of bed to go to work because I'm scared. I'm scared. I'll never forget my dad standing over the top of me going, "What do you mean you're scared? Dad, I can't move. I'm just paralyzed. I don't want to go out there. I think I have a drinking problem." And my stepmother standing there next to him going, "Oh," she said, "we just met that guy at Sears, and wasn't he in AA? Why don't we call him?" I'm thinking, where did you come from? You know what I mean? I just got this thought in my mind that maybe I got a drinking problem, and you're talking about taking me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure enough, she phones this guy. And, you know, the very next night, I opened the door, and there's this little guy about 70 years old looking at me, saying, he said, "Boy, you're kind of young." And I looked at him, and I said, "Man, you're kind of old." We didn't even say hi. He said, "Hi, I'm Freddie. I'm here from Alcoholics. I will take you to a meeting." And I'm going, oh, God. So this man takes me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, the man from Sears. And he said, "But first," he says, I got a surprise for you. We're going to go somewhere else first." And I'm like, "Oh no, what's going on?" So he takes me to this hospital, and I'd never been to this. I'd driven by it 100 times, but I'd never been there. And we get in the elevator, and I'm ready to have this, you know, the sense of impending doom is like all over me. I'm now trapped in an elevator with, you know, Freddie, and Freddie from Sears, and I don't know where I'm going. And I'll never forget when that elevator opened on the 7th floor. There she was staring at me in the face. Sister Mary Resentment was staring right at me. There was this picture of this Catholic nun. And, of course, it was Sister Ignatia. They took me to Ignatia Hall at St. Thomas Hospital because he wanted to take me to where Bill and Bob used to take their first drunk. So he thought this was a special treat that I should have. And there she is, Sister Mary Resentment. I immediately had this flashback back to this last experience of organized religion that left a bad taste in my mouth, and Sister Mary resentment was at the forefront of it. Fourth grade in this Catholic school, and I was getting a little bored with the whole slowness of this class that one day, and I was clowning around, and Sister Mary Carmel was actually her name, and she, you know, again singled me out and said, "Will you just sit still and be quiet?" And I told her to eat a sandwich with something in it. And if you're new, you can fill in the blank whatever you want to put in that sandwich, okay? Just whatever you want, put it in there. Anyway, I told her to eat that sandwich with that substance in it in front of the whole class. I'm in the fourth grade. I'm, I don't know, like 13, 12, whatever. I realized as soon as I said that was the dumbest thing I ever did in my life. Nobody needed to tell me that was the stupidest thing you ever did in your life. And Sister Mary resentment floated across the room. You know, like Halloween, and that robe was dangling in the air, and she grabbed me by the ear. And I mean, she had nails, and these weren't glued-on nails, these were nails. And she about ripped my ear off. She yanked me up, and I'll never forget, as I was being dragged out of my seat, I looked back at the classroom, and every one of them were, it was like the E.F. Hutton commercial, you know, the old one. They couldn't believe I said it either. So she's dragging me down the hallway, and she's foaming at the mouth. She takes me into the mother superior's office, so I guess that's what you call them, and she goes to the big cheese. You know what I mean? She can't handle this. She's got to take me to the big mama. So we go, she goes over and whispers in her ear what I said, because she couldn't repeat it out loud. It was so horrible. And Sister Ignatius, her eyeballs fly open, and she starts foaming at the mouth. And they started running back and forth, going, "What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" Well, the first thing they thought was, well, you know, you wash his mouth out with soap. But there wasn't any bar soap, so they twisted the powdered soap, and one of them held my arm and went, "Whoom!" Now that's as close to clean and sober as you ever want to get. It's right there. But that's what they were doing, because I said this horrible word, and that's what they were doing, to clean my mouth out, to purify me. And it all happened pretty quickly, and all I know is that I was asked to leave school for a while, because I just didn't know how to deal with that. When I was allowed back in school, I had to wear a little sign that they pinned on me. I had a string on it, I had to go into second grade. I was in the fourth grade, but they put me in the second grade. And when you're in fourth grade, you're big, and the second grade seats are small, so you sort of stand out. And I had this little sign that said, "I'm in the second grade because I act like a second grader. And I'm supposed to be in the fourth grade," or said something to that extent, you know. So it was like being on the chopping block, or, you know, the whatever the pilgrims did, you know, and those people, stockades. But that's the only way they knew how to deal with me. Now that, those two women were the agents of God. Now I think I was not on real good terms with the agents of God. And from that point on, I sort of figured, well, God doesn't want to have much to do with me, because look at what I've done to his agents, you know. They don't understand me or something. So I copped this attitude about organized religion, and I had that, and there she was staring me in the face, and this is my first, now I am not even to the AA meeting yet, this is where Freddie from Steers has taken me. Well, as we all know now, Sister Ignatia, if she is the Sister Teresa of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no question, one of the most unbelievable women in the world, who knew how to handle drunks, who loved drunks, sober ones more than the drinking ones. But here he was taking me to a special place where Bill and Bob would dry out the third man. And I was just all going over my head. He said, "Well, come on, let's go in. I'll introduce you to the guys." I'm going, "All right, great, you know. You want a shot?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, geez, it's about time, you know." And they're giving out vitamin B12 shots at this point. I was like, "Yeah, right, yeah, I'll pass. You know, I don't need a vitamin B12 shot." So I sat in there wondering, you know, what has my life come to? This is absolutely ridiculous. And then we ultimately get to this meeting that Freddie took me to, and oddly enough, a girl about my age spoke. And I tell you, we were the only two young people in the entire meeting, and that wasn't still enough. All I did was look at those people and compare myself to them, and I walked out of that meeting and sat in that parking lot and made that resolution that, you know, that's it. I'm not going to, you know, there ain't no way I'm going to, I'm just going to control my drinking from this day forward. So here I am now. At this point in March 7th, 1978, where I've fallen down on my knees and I have asked God and I've said the words and I meant them in total surrender in this this crummy little apartment on Market Street, God help me. And I meant it. I really did mean it the day that I said it. And I knew that I meant it. I knew something was different when I had said it, because I was done. After a year and a half of continuous drinking, after that first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I literally couldn't gather any more strength, and I was done. As I say, I didn't have another idea of what to do next. And I like to tell you that this is the part where I get sober and everything works really fine, but no. I went on to experience a little bit of dryness. Now, I knew just down the street was the detox center. I knew the medical director. We were good friends. So I thought I'd check myself in. And I walked down, checked myself into this place, and told him that I knew the medical director, and I thought I'd get some, you know, preferential treatment or some sort. And they just put me in this room with about 20 other people. And when Dr. DeBart came in the next day, I was really ashamed that I had to admit to my best friend, who was a doctor, my best golfing buddy, that that here I was in alcoholism. I'll never forget when he's looking over my chart, looking at me, and he said, "Well, it's about time." You know, and he'd known all along that I needed to be there, but being a good Al-Anon that he is, he knew he couldn't force-feed me. He'd taken me to this place on a couple of different occasions because I was to meet him there before we went golfing or this or there. And I thought it was kind of odd that, you know, in this detox world with all these people that couldn't drink. But at any rate, it was sort of paved the way for me to walk in there that night on March 6th, and I needed to go there. Now, Andy also realized that since we were very good friends that I couldn't remain in his facility. He just knew that we were too close, and he'd had enough of those Al-Anon meetings that he knew that I had to be removed from him. So he didn't send me to the Betty Hope Clinic out there where you can play golf in California or anything like that. He sent me to a sanitarium. And I'd never heard of a sanitarium before till I got there. All I can describe for you is that when we pulled up in that driveway down at Molly Stark Hospital, clouds formed over this place. And this is a gray stone building with bars in every single window, and it's about three stories high. It's in the middle of nowhere between Canton and Akron, or further down around Hartville, or somewhere in central Ohio. And I had no idea where I was because two people in a Volkswagen Bug took me there and dropped me off literally in front of the place, and then I was admitted. Now, on the third floor were severely retarded adults that no one really knew what to do with. On the second floor were terminally ill cancer patients. On the first floor was the rare disease floor, and the alcoholics ward was in the basement. And this was not a fun place when I was taken here, because I didn't know whether it was a place for nuts, for derelicts, for people that were morally bankrupt. I had no idea where I was. And I just decided that I was going to stay in my room for the whole time I'm here because I ain't going out there with those people. And so the counselor came in and said, "Listen, you got to come out of the room." I said, "No, I'm not going to come out of the room. I'm just going to stay right here. This is the place I want to be, and thank you." After about 3 days, I eventually came out for, you know, food and water, and but I didn't want to. I didn't want to associate with those people. And one of the first jobs they gave me was sitting with a wet drunk that was just brought in that day, and he was full of life and piss and vinegar, and he was pinching the nurses and having a great time, and we had to tie him down, and you know, then we had to sit and watch him. This is the job they give you when you're in the sanitarium, is for an hour you go sit and watch a drunk so that he doesn't gag or go into convulsions or whatever, and you just sit there and smell this person. You know, because it's just coming out of me, and he's all bloated, and he was older. And I sat there for an hour and just sat there and watched this guy make these weird noises. Later on that night, my door was open, and I remember waking up just briefly, and I remember seeing this stretcher go by on wheels with a person laying on it with a sheet over his head, or over his entire body. I could see the full silhouette of his body, and it was that man they brought in that day, and he was dead. And I just woke up just enough to see that thing go by, and then I went back to sleep. And it's weird. I woke up the next day, and I was thinking, you know, where's that one guy? I said, "Oh, well, he died last night." I thought it was a dream. I had no idea. At any rate, the counselor there said, "When you leave this place in a couple of days, you're going to need to have a support system, and we found that Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing to help you. And we're going to have some people that come down here. They're sponsors that will talk to you." And whatever. So this one guy came down, I forget him, he didn't look like me. Big, hair was greased back, and had a leather jacket on, and big boots, and described, chasing his wife around the house with a butcher knife, trying to kill her in his last drunk. as if he was reliving it right in front of me, and sweat was breaking out on his forehead, and he had these big tattoos, and I tell you, this guy scared me, and I asked him, if you'd just excuse me 1 minute, left, went down to the counselor's office and opened up the door and said, you know, who is this person? Is this my sponsor? She said, no, he's just here to talk to him. I was relieved. I'll never forget how relieved I was that this guy wasn't going to kill me with a butcher knife. The next day, another person came down from Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, he was completely different. This was an older, more distinguished gentleman. Had gray hair and had this beautiful tweed coat on with leather, you know, the leather patch on the elbows, and had penny loafers on and nice pants and a tie. He smoked a pipe, a little aromatic tobacco. And I thought, God, what a nice image, you know. And he was a professor of law. I'm thinking, this is good, too. I need a lawyer. I'll never forget going through this checklist as I'm looking at this man. And he talked in a very eloquent voice, and he, his name was Hollis. And I thought, well, my God, this will be the greatest, you know, this will be my sponsor. This guy's great. And from that day on, we had the best relationship you could ever have. I mean, it was remarkably wonderful. I never called him. He never called me. And this sort of prevailed for the last, 10 or 12 months. And I'll never forget, I saw him on my anniversary, my first year anniversary. He was at the party. And I sat down next to him, talked to him for a couple of minutes, and then, you know, went on my way. I was just hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not immersed in recovery. I still was comparing myself. You were different. I was resentful. I was belligerent. I was arrogant, I was pompous, I was haughty, I was conceited, I was detached from you, I was anything but sober. And this attitude prevailed till an experience happened. My sponsor that I never used had a massive heart attack, and he was in Akron City Hospital, where Dr. Bob used to work. And so I went in, it thought occurred to me maybe I should go see my sponsor. So I went into the hospital room, and I'll never forget, as I walked in the room, he's all geared down and all these wires and everything. He lit up and had a smile on his face. He was glad to see me. I'll never forget how it's like I walked into the room and he transformed. And he said, Craig, and his mouth was real dry. He said, I'm so glad you came here. He said, I was just thinking about you. He says, I think it's really important that you get busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I really think it's important that you start to work the steps. And you've got to get a foothold on what this recovery is all about. And I'm going through my mind and I'm thinking that you need to have some type of service for it. You need to be doing it. I said, you know, Hollis, the weirdest thing happened. Just the other night, these people asked me to moderate this panel of old-timers called Gratitude Sunday. And he goes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's the kind of thing you need to start doing. And I said, well, it's tomorrow, actually, on Sunday. And here I am, this, you know, 13-month dry, you know, piece of, you know, flaming sobriety, you know, with no serenity whatsoever. And I'm going to moderate a panel of old-timers. Now, these old-timers were still the legacies of Bill and Bob. And they're Norm Young and Herb and Ann Craw. I mean, people that knew Bill and Bob, that were sponsored by them. They're living relics of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to moderate the panel of old-timers. And Hollis said, that's exactly what we want for you to do. And that's what, and I'll never forget, as I left, the thought occurred to me to ask something about him. Like, how you doing? And, you know, when are they going to operate on you? And he said, well, tomorrow. He said, I think it's at 3 o'clock. He said, yes, it's 3 o'clock. Well, that was the same time I was to moderate this panel. And I had a watch in front of me, and I, you know, it was 3 o'clock, and I was getting ready to start the proceedings for Gratitude Sunday. And I said a prayer about my sponsor. Took a minute, and I said a prayer about my sponsor. Got through the dealings of that day, and then I went home that night, and I called his wife, Flo. And I dialed up, and I said, Flo, this is Craig Schreiner, and I just want to call and see how Hollis is doing. She said, he died today. He didn't make it through his operation. And something happened to me at that moment. And it never occurred to me that I never used the man. All of a sudden, this person that I didn't know was gone. Just gone. I just saw him yesterday. He was gone. For good. Forever. And something happened to me. I said, is there anything I can do to help you? And she started to, she just broke down. She said, God, I don't know what I'm going to do. I got the kids, I got school, I got my funeral arrangements. I said, I'll be right over. Go over to her house. The thought occurred to me, stop by the store. buy some milk and some bread and you know, pick up some things. And I did this, and I took it over there, and I just put it on the table, and I said, what do we need to do? You know, and she said, well, I got to call the funeral operations, and his ex-wife, I got to handle that. I don't know how to deal with all that, you know. And so whatever we needed to do for the next 3 or 4 days, whatever she needed done, I did it. There was no thinking of anything else, just what do we do next? And it was the fastest 3 days of my whole life. And as I was witnessing the wake of this individual that I didn't know, I didn't use him, I didn't call him, I didn't hang out with him, I didn't do the steps like he said, I'm watching this wake of hundreds of people come to his funeral. Hundreds of people from Alcoholics Anonymous, the mayor of Akron, the dean of the university, people of stature in Akron, Ohio, hundreds of members of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's many, and they're all talking about this man I don't know. And he's gone. And I'm thinking, what the hell did I miss? Now I'm kind of wandering around in this blissful sobriety that I got after my sponsor's in the ground, trying to figure out what the hell happened. The thing I used to do when I didn't drink that first year and a half, when I wasn't, you know, when I would go to one meeting a week, was I played golf every chance I could. That's the only relief I had from the misery of my existence and dryness of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was doing what I normally did one day, playing golf alone and cheating. Yeah, that's right. Now think about that. Who am I cheating? Is it the other guys that aren't there on phone? I'm cheating. Maybe I'm cheating. Me. I missed the ball. See, that doesn't count. What do you mean that doesn't count? Now, there's a differentiation I want to make between denial and delusion. I can deny that I was ever at this conference. If someone say, oh, did you go? No, I was never there. I know I was here, but I could deny that I was here. But there was a period in my life where I lived under the delusion that I could drink normally someday. And a delusion means I believe something that is absolutely wrong. Here I am, you know, swinging this club and missing these balls, in denial that I just missed that shot, deluding myself that that never happened. And I found myself standing over my second shot on a par 5 hole. And people are on this green. There's three people on a green way down there. And I'm thinking to myself, well, it's a par 5. I've hit my tee shot. I can't hit that green in two. It's too far away. So I thought to myself, well, I'll even just lay up just to be safe. I won't even try to hit it. And I read a little bit about this guy named Jack Nicklaus who wrote this book about, you know, if you want to be a good golfer, you know, take an inventory. Imagine this guy, this great golfer, saying, inventory your shots. Physically take an inventory and, you know, mentally project the shots you want to hit and do all these things. And I did that. For some reason, I stood there and I thought about the shot I wanted to hit. And I took less club, so I just thought I'd hit a little shot and lay up. I took that club back, and I, for the first time, I just sort of easy did it. I never easy did golf in my life. Golf to me was grab the club and hit that thing as hard as you can and enforce your will on it. You know what I mean? I never took golf lessons. I never did. I just grab the ball and kill it. And if I miss it, you don't count it. So I took this attitude. I took this inventory. And I took less club and I took my first humble swing ever at golf. And the ball took off like a rocket ship. I never hit a shot that good to this day. Matter of fact, I looked at the club to make sure I had the right club, and I realized that this thing is going so far, it's going to hit the green where those three people are. And the ball almost hit this one little person standing on the right side. God, I was so relieved. He jumped to the side and missed it. So now I'm walking up to the green with my bag through humiliation. You know, I'm going to learn a little about humility here. And this person that I almost hit was this new guy I saw at a meeting the other night, the one meeting I would go to. I'll never forget when this new guy came into the room. He was standing over in the back. Nobody had ever seen him before. His coat was drawn over his left hand. He had a cigarette stuck on his lip with a long ash on it, and he had a cup of coffee, and his tie was undone. I thought, he's new. I went flying across the room. I said, hi, my name is Craig. You keep coming to these meetings, and these people can help you. And I just went on my self-centered way, doing whatever I was doing, lying and cheating. I hated you. I didn't want to be there. You know, I mean, it was the only meeting I went to. And I'll never forget, he stood back and smiled, and he said, "Thanks." And he said it, and the ash didn't come off the cigarette. I don't know how that does it. I was just looking at that ash, figuring it's going to fall. Well, here, I almost hit this guy with a golf ball, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, here I am, the walking big book, you know, out here, and I've almost killed this guy with a golf ball. But before I could apologize, this guy looked at me and said, "That was a nice shot," he said. "What'd you hit?" And I said, "Oh, it's five wood, you know." And before I could apologize, he said, "Why don't you join us?" And I said, "Okay, great." So we played the rest of the round together. He didn't throw me off the golf course, and, you know, I mean, I could have been thrown off the golf course for doing that sort of thing. A thought occurred to me, he's new, taken to a meeting. I said, "Do you want to go to a meeting?" And he looked at me and he said, "Sure," he said. So I'm driving to a meeting. You know, I'm driving this guy to a meeting. And I'm thinking, okay, now what do we tell these guys? And all I could think of were bumper stickers. You know, we read the big book and we don't drink and we go to meetings and first things first and easy does it. And that's all I know. And I'm telling them all this stuff I know how to stay sober. It's on these bumper stickers that I see at the meeting. We got to the meeting, and it was a speaker meeting on Saturday night in Copley, Ohio. After the meeting, a thought occurs to me. He's new. Fellowship. "Do you want to go get something to eat?" And he looked at me and he said, "Sure," he said. So now we're going to a restaurant to have fellowship. So I'm driving to the restaurant. I'm thinking, I better start telling him about, you know, this recovery stuff. And I was saying, okay, now, we have different kinds of meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this was a speaker meeting, and there's discussion meetings, and there's some for men and some for women, and then there's open meetings and closed meetings, and we've got an intergroup office, and I'll never forget, a thought pops in my mind. I wonder where the intergroup office is. And I was telling about literature and all this stuff, and I'm thinking, I should start reading some of this literature. And I was going through this whole inventory of things I was telling him that I had not done myself. We get to the restaurant. We've ordered. The food is in front of us. I've got a mouthful of food. Okay, I'm chewing away on my hamburger. And now this is the first time this person's ever had a chance to say anything. Ever, since we've been together. 2 hours in and the first time I met him. And he asked me about something that was in the spiritual appendix. And I'm chewing my thing going, "What in the heck is that?" I'm thinking. "Is that in a big book or something?" "Oh, yeah, it's in the back." I said, "Well, I haven't gotten that far," I said, something like that. I don't know what I said. Well, then he asked me, "Well, what about something on page 27 then? You know, about, you know, the doctor and Rowan." Well, it's a little vague, you know. What would happen there? And then he asked me about something on page 45, you know, and then he said something about a 12 and 12. I'm going, "What is a 12 and 12? The thought occurs to me, maybe he's not new. "Hey, George, how long have you been at Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said it this loud in a restaurant. And I remember hearing a couple of people looking over like that. Now, the day's only, I've only been with this guy 3 hours. I almost killed him with a golf ball, and the restaurant knows this guy's an Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I asked him, I said, "Well, you know, how long have you been in AA?" I'll never forget these little blue eyes looking at me, and they pierced through me like laser beams. And he said, "A reasonable length of time, Trey." "Tell me what else you know is in the big book." Oh, my God. Oh. My body goes to 107 degrees Fahrenheit. I felt like that time when I was backing out of my sleeping bag after my first drunk. Food was coming up that just went down. I was a little uneasy. My palms were wet. I'm thinking, oh, my God, he's not new. And I said, "Excuse me, and I'm really sorry. How long have you been in Alcoholics Anonymous?" He says, "Oh, 17 years. Tell me what else you know is in the big book." Now this new guy that I was going to sponsor, that's my sponsor that I have today. That is the sponsor I have today. Now, let's go back to November. My sponsor that I never used, Hollis, has been dead for 4 days. It's now Thanksgiving night. And here I am at the Episcopal Hospital, the same hospital where Bob called when he had that glimpse, that spark in his mind, call another alcoholic. He called what was the pastor at this church. Well, there was a meeting there on Thursday night. Thursday night's always Thanksgiving. For some reason, the meeting was closed because the whole church was closed that evening. I go up the door, it doesn't open. I'm thinking, oh my God, there's not a meeting. And I need a meeting, I'm thinking. You know, my sponsor's gone. I don't know what's happening. As I'm walking out, another car drives into the parking lot. I'll never forget. There were only two cars there. Who is it? It's this new guy that I almost killed about 3 days before. I'm sure that as soon as George saw me, he wanted to do 180 degrees and floor the car. But he drove up to me and I said, George, how you doing? And his eyes kind of rolled a little bit. I said, the meeting's closed. And he said, well, why don't we go get some coffee, he said. I said, great. So we went and we got some coffee. And then at night I asked him if he would be my sponsor. I told him that Hollis had died and I'd never used him, that he was gone, and that I really felt a little, you know, disoriented, and I'd realized I never used him. And I said, would you be my sponsor? And he said, why? Oh, that aggravated me. That really aggravated me. And he really aggravated me. He said, I'm thinking, why? Because I asked you. That should be enough in my pompous, conceited, you know, mindset. And he knew I was really flustered. He said, no, why? He said, do you even know if I have a sponsor? Do you even know if I've worked the steps? Do you even know if I have a home meeting, home group? Do you know if I even sponsor other people? It said, yada, yada, yada. I'm thinking, all right, do you have a home group? Do you go to meetings? Do you sponsor other people? You know, yeah. But what was he doing? He was trying to get me to think. To think. And he said, well, you know, I'm glad to work with you, etc. However, he said, do you have a dictionary? Well, yeah, I have a dictionary. As soon as anybody says anything, I always people please them instantly. I can finish your sentence for you if you want. Yeah, I have a dictionary. He said, I want you to look up some words when you get home tonight. And I'm thinking, well, this guy's a little different than my last sponsor. He has homework. You know, this is interesting. I want you to look up two words, I and we. Oh, my God. I am thinking to myself, you know, who the heck doesn't know the difference between I and we? I said, George, you know, I and we? I said, I know the difference. No, you don't. No, you don't. And I'm just standing there thinking, yes, I do. You got yourself to Alcoholics Anonymous, he said. We can keep you sober. I didn't know the difference. The very first thing he did was deflate the ego. I, me is all I knew. It was the only way I knew how to think. I didn't know the difference between I and we. I didn't, but I thought I did. It's cunning, it's baffling, it's powerful. We proceeded to work through the steps. We got to step four, and with the guidance of this sponsor, I'll glaze over some things quickly. What time is it? It's 10 o'clock? What time did I start? Time to quit. I'll do the inventory and we'll get out of here. We got in the habit together looking up words and getting definitions. And I did the inventory and I did it as best I could. When we came to fears, he asked me if I looked up the word, and I said, yeah, I looked up the word. He wanted to know what it meant. And I said, to sort of live in the future, project things that weren't happening. And he'd ask me, why do you want to live in the future? And I never realized that that's what I was doing. And then began to show me that the way I dissolve these fears is through faith of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, that it works. And sure enough, through the actions of daily activity, I was able to do that. When it came to the resentments, I looked up that word, and it meant to live in the past, to refuel the hurt of the past. And I had all these justified reasons why I lived the way that I had. And he showed me in many, many places in that big book that really my problems were all my own making, and that I had to eliminate the word blame from my dictionary and my vocabulary, and that I needed to understand that my problems fundamentally were all of my own making, and the only person I could really change was myself. And so when I wasn't living in the past or fearing the future, I was experiencing a lot of guilt about sex in the present. And when I read that part of my inventory that I never wanted to read to anybody about all the sexual, you know, the things that I'd done and the conduct I never really wanted to spell or talk to anybody about, as I looked up at him after I read this thing continuously without taking a break, I caught him yawning. He was yawning. And he knew I caught him yawning. And he said, well, it was boring, he said, you know. And then he told me about part of his sex life, and he was right. Mine was boring. I was thinking, God, I didn't know those things were legal. You know what I mean? What's the point? The point is that ultimately I shared all the things I never really wanted to share about anybody. But I didn't stand in judgment of myself, and I didn't quite understand that at that point. But George planted the seed of self-respect that day in me. He said three things to me when we were done. He said, I forgive you for everything that you've done. He said, God has forgiven you for everything that you've done. And now, from here on out, I want you to forgive yourself for what you've done. And I got on this little spiritual dry drunk after my fifth step and began to think that I knew a little more about other people, and they didn't run meetings the way I think they should. I gossiped about certain people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if they didn't really work your program like I thought, I sort of passed judgment and reserved my right or did some yeah buts and closed my mind to different things and created a big turmoil. I went from the self-pity dry drunk and Molly Stark, I don't want to be an alcoholic, to the happy dry drunk. Well, what do you mean? Go to meetings and you know, put chairs up and make coffee. That's for the new person. What do you mean pick up that new guy and take him to a meeting? I was thinking to myself, what if he throws up in my car? You know, what if he throws up in my car? And I went on this happy dry drunk, and the happy dry drunk got worse. It got into the spiritual dry drunk, where I really thought I knew what was going on. I got a letter from New York Young People's International Conference that wanted me to come and talk. Called my sponsor in my exultation. I was so excited about this. Called him up and asked him, I said, George, I was asked to come to the 25th International Conference of Young People to talk, and he said, did you look up those words I gave you the other day? He interrupted me. I said, what words were that? Pompous, conceited, arrogant, haughty. He ripped off like 20 words that I didn't remember, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I don't remember any of these things. And he said, you were at the meeting the other night, weren't you? He said, there was a new person in the back of the room, wasn't there? And I'm thinking, I don't remember. He said, that's right, you don't remember. There was a new person who had 17 days there, and you didn't shake his hand, did you? He says, your sobriety, what you call recovery, stinks, he said. As a matter of fact, I want you to take the next week, look around Alcoholics Anonymous in Akron, and find yourself another sponsor, because obviously you aren't getting it. I called him to tell him how great I was. We're still on the same phone conversation that the people want me to come to New York and talk, and I'm telling him how great I am, and he's firing me. This isn't working here. So I started to look up the words. I said, George, what were those words again? Pompous, et cetera, et cetera. And I looked them up right there. I'll never forget. I was standing right in my room right at that point in time. And we got to all these words, and I begged him not to fire me, and he didn't, and et cetera. And I was ready to hang up. He said, what was in that letter he sent me? And he said, oh, I'm reading it. I said, oh, they want me to be on a panel. Before I could even finish the word panel, they said, what's the subject? I didn't know there were subjects. And I'm reading. Will you just give me a second? What's the subject? I said, will you just give me humility. George has a linoleum floor in his room, and he drops the phone because he's laughing so hard. And he hits the floor, and I'm going, and I can hear him going, ah, 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 ah. 3 minutes of this stuff. George smokes three packs of Pall Malls a day. After he gets done with his laughing convulsion, he goes into his coughing convulsion, where all the stuff that he smoked for 6 days is coming up. I'm thinking he's going to die. I can hear him die. And he finally gains his composure and puts the phone up and says, what are you going to say? It's only through repeated humiliation that I've learned anything about humility. Now let me close with this. I did go to that conference, and it was that very day that I changed. I went to that meeting the next night, and I saw that new guy, and I shook his hand, and I actually began to sponsor him that very next day, and he changed my life. And that set off a series of reactions where I realized I have to give this. I have to become willing to give it away. And then something transformed and happened to me. I began to become so free and so serene in some respects that I began to become a human being I never ever dreamed possible by putting myself third. And I continued to make that as the focus, and it's the only reason I'm here in front of you today. I went back to college and got a degree, and now I do the things that I want to do that I've never dreamed possible. That I do. I have a job. I have the self-respect. I have respect of my family and my peers, my fellow AAs. I get up on the horse. I fall off the horse. But all I know is in this rocking chair of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am safe as long as I'm in the rooms of AA. I was at this conference in New York, and we all went to the intergroup office in Akron, Ohio, in New York City at World Headquarters. And I'll never forget, all of us went in there, and we were looking through the archives, and we told everybody we were from Akron, and we knew a lot of the people before they had died, and they gave us a special little tour, which was kind of fun. And Bill Secretary was still there at the time, and so she paid special attention to us. As I was leaving, I saw this letter on the wall, and it was a letter written by Dr. Young to Wilson, Bill Wilson, when he was writing the big book. Because Young wrote to Wilson, Wilson wrote to Young when he was writing the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, or co-authoring it, and said, Dr. Young, what is the spiritual experience? What is this thing that you talk about? And I think the letter's been in Grapevine a couple times. I'll surmise it to say this. Young looked up the word alcohol and traced it to its origin because he couldn't really define what the spiritual experience was. He was very humble about this in his response to Wilson. And he said, all I know is I've traced the word alcohol to its origin. It comes from a Latin word, which means spiritus. And I looked up that word one night in the Cambridge Unabridged Dictionaries in the College of Worcester when I was back in college. And I was in this fit of open-mindedness. It was wonderful. It was amazing. It only lasted about 5 minutes, but it was really great. And I looked up the word alcoholic in the Cambridge Unabridged Dictionaries. Now, these are the biggest dictionaries in the world. There's nothing bigger than this. And it traces words all the way to its origin. Sure enough, alcohol goes to the word spiritus. And spiritus is even defined as the breath of life. That's what I had. That very first drink at 13, I had experienced the breath of life. But something happened. Alcohol turned on me. I thought it was my power. The cucumber in front of you turned into a pickle. There ain't no pickle going back to a cucumber. It happened, but that was the breath of life that I experienced in alcohol. That's why I wanted to drink it. And then I had another word to look up. My sponsor always told me something. I never forget. I said, George, you know, when I was mistaking you as someone who was brand new in AA, why didn't you stop me? And he said, oh, no, you are beautiful, he said. You were beautiful, he said. He said, you had all that enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. Nobody ever told me I had enthusiasm. He said, you didn't know what you're talking about, but you had all that enthusiasm. Everybody said I was hyper. I had short span, learning disabilities. I was hypertense. I was this, I was that. I had disorders. I had this. Nobody ever said, that's enthusiasm. Pure, unadulterated enthusiasm. But he said that's what I had. I looked up that word one night in the dictionary, in the Cambridge Unabridged Dictionaries, and it comes from a Greek word called entheos, and it means inspired by God. Pockets inspired by God. And I've blown this by talking too long. I just want you to know that you have honored me with your attention for as long as you have, and I really, really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.